I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly biotechnology podcast that's not just about biotechnology. Providing information to help you change hearts and minds. Moving innovations to application with communication.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology with a focus on biotechnology and new innovations that can help people and the planet. I'm Paul Vincelli, sitting in for Dr. Kevin Falta. And as I always say, Kevin, I thank you again for the opportunity to do this. And today we're going to be talking about ways to engineer resistance to plant viruses and some of the challenges that that poses. And I promise an interesting topic. I'm most excited to have our guest, who is Devang Mehta, Dr. Devang Mehta. From the Institute of Plant Molecular Biology in the Department of Biology at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. So welcome, Devang, and thanks for being part of our program.
No, thank you for having me.
So you've taken in two papers, which by the way are posted on, you've posted them on a preprint server. What is actually the name? How do you pronounce the name of that preprint server?
It's BioArchive.
BioArchive. Okay, yeah. Makes sense. Yeah, and we're going to put links to those two papers on the Talking Biotech website so people can get to them easily if they're interested. I am curious, before we talk about your work, I've never used a preprint server. What is that about? It's obviously something you can do once your paper is submitted, but tell us about that. What is a preprint server?
Sure. So preprint server is basically some place online where you can post a scientific manuscript before it goes through formal peer review in a journal. And the idea basically for BioArchive, it's inspired by physicists, because in physics it's very common for researchers to submit their manuscripts as soon as they're written to their own server, which is called Archive. People can comment on your document over there, and you know, you get some sort of informal feedback before or during a formal peer review in an academic journal.
So, I guess the question is, it must be a way of protection of your work. You're putting it out for the public to view, and it's in the process of being reviewed by a peer review magazine. Is that sufficient protection, or what is I've heard of these, I've downloaded papers, but I've never really understood how they work.
So more than protection, I think the idea is to give as much access as possible to the paper, because BioArchive is completely open. So even if your paper later on gets accepted and published in a closed access journal, you still have the preprint online.
So it's really from the public service standpoint of access.
Exactly.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, that's a good example. So we're going to talk about cassava in Africa. What got you, and we're going to talk about virus engineering, virus resistance. What got you interested in this whole area of synthetic biology? I know you describe yourself as a synthetic biologist, molecular biology. Give our listeners a bit of background into you, the scientist in person.
Sure. So I'm Indian. So I grew up in India, and I did my undergraduate degree in biotechnology in India. During my undergraduate degree, I got involved in a competition called iGEM, which stands for the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition. And this is at the time it was organized by some researchers at MIT in the US. And it's basically a competition of undergraduate researchers who try to to engineer bacteria to do interesting things. And that's where I got first exposed to genetic engineering and biotechnology and synthetic biology. And then I did my master's in synthetic biology, so a more formal training in the subject, at Imperial College London in the UK. And this was, again, working on bacteria. And then for my PhD, I interviewed at a lot of places, and almost by chance, I landed on this this project on cassava and engineering resistance to plant viruses.
And you're heading off to a soon, I understand, to a postdoctoral position at the University of Alberta. Is that right?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, great. So cassava, many of our listeners certainly know it's a staple crop, but some may not. It's a staple crop that's eaten in, I think it originates from somewhere in Brazil, but is now consumed in Africa, Brazil, and South America, and other parts of the world. Tell us about cassava and viruses in cassava.
Okay, so you're right. Cassava originates in South America, and right now actually the major production happens in East Asia, and then cassava is also mainly grown as a staple food in sub-Saharan Africa. So it's really where the source of calories for people living there, and unfortunately. Only in Africa and India, the plant is severely affected by virus diseases, and the virus disease that I work on is called the cassava mosaic disease, and it's caused by a DNA virus. And basically, this disease causes quite widespread damage. So, on average, about 24% annual losses in Africa are caused due to this.
How much did you say?
24% annually on average.
Wow. Was in Africa.
In Africa.
Yeah. Wow. That's certainly something I noticed as a plant pathologist. So the one you work with, in fact, your paper, I think, mentions there is a population of virus species. These are at least cassava mosaic virus, African cassava mosaic virus is a Bogomil virus, single-stranded DNA. For those who know what that means, and for those who don't, we'll get into that. But spread by white flies, and cassava is vegetatively propagated, right? So it's really going to be at risk for virus infection.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a tough problem to control, you know?
Yeah. Right. It's also interesting because, I mean, the plant is originally from Southern America, but the virus itself has been is not present in South America. So it was something that the plant encountered for the first time when it was transferred by traders from South America into Africa.
So it has some origin, likely origin in Africa. We just don't know where it is.
Exactly.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. As a plant pathologist, I know that Gemini viruses which is the family for the Bogomil viruses are really challenging, especially in the tropics, and tough to control, even through sometimes conventional breeding. And in fact, you pointed out to me, we had one of the people in your program do a Talking Biotech podcast several years ago. You want to tell us a little bit about tell us more about the virus interactions with cassava.
Okay. So you, as you mentioned, it's a Gemini virus, and this basically means that it's, the virus is present as single-stranded DNA molecules, which are like circular DNA molecules. Mm-hmm. And these are introduced into the plant by white flies. So white flies feed on the plant leaves, and they inject the virus directly into the phloem stream of the plant. The plant tries to defend itself against the virus through a lot of different mechanisms. And one of this is RNA interference, which is the plant's natural way of responding to the virus.
Okay. So RNAi RNA interference is sometimes called RNAi, and it's a natural process of the plant to suppress viral infection, mm-hmm. as well as regulate genes, right? Can we just say that as well?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So we've got a plant struggling to fight back against a Bogoma virus, the Gemini virus infection, and it loses. And, you know, it, or at least it, you know, loses the battle so that, you know, so that the plant is suffering and so are the people that depend on that plant. So so you got into studying and engineering defense mechanisms and studying how they work. So how about if we start with the RNAi work that you've done?
So the way RNAi works is when the virus enters the plant, the virus needs to start replicating. And to do that, what it does is it basically sits in the plant cell's nucleus and it starts transcribing RNA. So that means that the DNA from the virus's DNA starts coding for mRNA that then results in the production of viral proteins, which the virus needs to be able to replicate and produce more copies of itself. And then what the plant tries to do is to stop this process and to shut it down. And to do this, it uses the virus's RNA as kind of a template to produce shorter RNA molecules, which then bind to the virus's RNA and degrade the virus's RNA. So it stops the virus from producing new proteins and then essentially stops it from replicating. And this is how the plant or all plants respond to all viruses generally.
All viruses, okay, right. So it's to shut down the messenger RNA signal that's coming from the plants.
There's also some evidence that this process also results in epigenetic marks on the virus's DNA itself. So it also has an effect on stopping the virus's DNA from producing new RNA.
From transcribing new RNA. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. And so again, this is a natural process, right? And the process, tell me if I've got any of the details incorrect here. This process is used by plants both to defend itself against viral infection by shutting down the messenger RNA of the virus, and also to regulate its own genes.
Yes.
Right? I mean, we basically the plant is using the same molecular machinery to regulate itself in its own healthy ways or hopefully healthy ways for the plant, but also to defend itself against virus.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay. So once again, for the listener's sake, that this would be called RNAi, RNA interference, or sometimes referred to as gene silencing, but I think that's a bit of an umbrella term which encompasses a little bit more than RNAi. If viruses or plants have RNAi, functioning RNAi as a defense mechanism, why do viruses even occur in plants? Why are we even concerned about them?
Yeah, so RNAi is present, in almost all plants, and it's really active against viruses. But you have to imagine that, you know, there's kind of like an arms race between viruses and plants.
Okay.
So as soon as the plant tries to fight a virus, the virus kind of fights back. So a lot of plant viruses have evolved a lot of mechanisms by which they can stop the process of RNAi or inhibit the process of RNAi.
So numerous mechanisms exist in.
A lot of different mechanisms.
Okay. Okay. All right. Good. Well, that's. So we've sort of come to the point where we understand that the virus wants to succeed. The plant wants to win the battle, and there's this tug of war going on, or battle between two organisms. And so, how do we help the plant? Okay. I mean, I'm asking now, I guess. What your work is about. Let's go into...
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
So one way, and this is a very well-established technology now, is to try and help plants defend themselves against viruses using RNAi. One approach is to try and ramp up this process. So early on, what a lot of scientists did was to try and take pieces of viral DNA and make the plant transcribe this viral DNA. And this kind of immunized the plant against new viruses coming in, because
the wild DNA is from the virus, right?
Yeah. So a bit of wild DNA is then introduced into the plant, and this produces RNAs that then can be used to trigger RNA silencing against the normal wild type virus that enters the plant. And this has been very successful. So the best example is is the rainbow papaya in Hawaii, which was really successful and is still successful almost 20 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. It's a good example indeed.
So this process worked really well for RNA viruses. And one reason is that when it works against RNA viruses, it's directly targeting the genome of the RNA virus because RNA viruses have a RNA genome. With DNA viruses, like Gemini viruses, it was implemented a little later. So the first report was in about 2007, 2009 in terms of field trials. And then in my lab in 2009, we developed plants which were which used this approach. So we actually introduced a piece of wild DNA, which was kind of restructured so that it would produce double-stranded RNA. And then we produced this wild double-stranded RNA within the plant, and the plant is able to use this wild double-stranded RNA to produce short RNA molecules that can give immunity to further infections by viruses. Mm-hmm. So this was done in greenhouse experiments in 2009.
So direct, basically, you've created a double-stranded, or your program, the program you're in, has created a double-stranded RNA that then sort of guides the molecular machinery of the cell, the plant cell, to create these small RNAs which silence the viral replication and the viral genome, basically.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Good. Yeah, I'm saying good because I'm glad to make sure, I've explained it well. All right. So I think we've sort of framed it well. Tell us about the results from your paper.
So this was done originally in Kasawa in 2009 by my supervisor. And then when I came into the project, our lab was already implementing some field trials of these plants that were developed back in 2009. So this field trial took place in Kenya. So right at the border of Kenya and Uganda, actually. And as you mentioned earlier, the disease, the cassava mosaic disease, is not caused by just one species of virus, but by several species of viruses. And this means that these are viruses that look a lot like each other and they behave very similarly, but they're distinct enough to be considered different species. And East Africa is actually a center of diversity for these species. And that's why we had the field trial happening in Kenya and Uganda, so at the border of Kenya and Uganda. So we did a field trial over there, which was for about 50 weeks. And when I came into the project, we were harvesting these the results of these trials and harvesting some samples. And then I decided to try and see what was happening to the viruses, how were they responding to the RNAi engineered plants. And in order to do this, I had to try and create a new method for sequencing wild DNA.
Yeah, I want to highlight that this is a new sequence or new sequencing method, right? Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Because currently, or at the time, the latest sequencing technology can only sequence smaller segments of DNA. So for example, even the human genome, which was sequenced in 2000, was sequenced from small pieces of DNA, which were then computationally assembled together. And this becomes problematic when you're dealing with the population of viruses, because they're sometimes so similar that you could, you have a lot of different sequences which are very short in length. But when you try to put them together, you might just mix them up. So you might have, you might create a completely new incorrect sequence because they just look so similar. Mm-hmm. So I had to create the sequencing method which could basically sequence individual virus molecules in a single sequencing read. So we could basically read the full sequence of a wild genome without breaking it up into smaller pieces.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Of a wild genome of the virus.
Exactly.
Right.
So I did this with both our test plants, which were the plants that express the RNAi against the virus, as well as wild-type plants, which were non-transgenic and in which the virus could replicate unimpeded. And essentially, my results showed that RNAi worked really well against a certain population of viruses, but it left the second population viruses untouched. So what this means is that in our wild-type plants, we had two distinct populations of viruses, and these were two distinct species of viruses. And then one of these species was completely abolished in our RNAi transgenic plants, but the second species was kind of left untouched. Mm-hmm. And this kind of showed us that what the limitation of this technology is and how we could re-engineer this to try and take this into account.
Yeah, I thought it was really a very nice sort of knot, and you've tied it in a knot up to this point, as far as understanding why the technology might fail, and fail in the sense of viral disease still developing, even though you've done a good job of suppressing the original target virus. And so to make sure everybody, has understood, the key thing here, it sounds to me like, is that this was a viral mixture that occurs in cassava, and the target species that is targeted by the gene silencing, the RNAi approach you've taken, that virus was suppressed quite well, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. In field plants, but the other virus that with a substantially different sequence was not suppressed and sort of blossomed in the plants because it was no longer being competed by this target viral species. So the key was the presence of the viral mixture. Is that a accurate summary?
I think so. I think so. So what we found was it wasn't just the target virus itself, but any virus that was about 90% similar to the target virus that was effectively suppressed.
Okay.
But then there was the second population, which was about 70% similar, so only 70% similar to the target, and this was kind of left unchecked.
Okay. Good. Yeah. So really, selection is taking place as a result of your siRNA approach or RNAi approach. You're basically controlling the population of viruses that have a 90% or more match to the target sequence that you've engineered, but leaving untouched the ones that have a 70% match or less, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So are there different? I guess I wasn't clear on this. Are these two different populations? Just two different species, or is there a complex of species that occurs in both cases?
So in the wild type plants, we had two. So it's kind of difficult to say which species it, but just based on similarity, we found that one species was one group of viruses was very closely related to the African cassava mosaic virus species. And the second group of viruses was more closely related to the East African cassava mosaic virus species.
Okay.
And in the transgenic plants, it was the African cassava mosaic virus species were absent, or they were effectively silenced, whereas the East African cassava mosaic virus were able to survive.
Okay. So it really just highlights I think you even said it very well, the need to account for the full viral diversity that will be present when you engineer an RNAi approach.
I think that's our main point, which is that it becomes really essential then to keep monitoring mm-hmm. the extent to which these viruses are diverse and try and take this into account when we try to engineer strategies.
Not so much to abandon the strategy, but to stay on top of whatever changes are happening in the viral populations so that you can adjust the RNAi.
Mm-hmm. I think, in fact, the results do show that the technology itself was really successful against the target virus. It was just the virus that wasn't targeted, that was the problem.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. Your graphs show that beautifully. And we've got all the experiences of, most especially the papaya, but also summer squash in the United States. There are some mm-hmm. viral resistant varieties. And against a single species, or against the target species, the RNAi seems to work very well. It's just your paper just highlights, okay, but there's that possibility that could be others that are not present in the field that are not targeted by your technology, and we just have to make sure they are. What one more question before we take a break. What about, are there any conserved sequences in this, you know, in the, among the viruses that you worked with, so conserved that they would occur across these different species, or do you have to have two different RNAi approaches?
So in fact, the RNAi sequence that we used in our plants was actually among the most conserved areas of the virus.
Okay.
So we already tried to take this into account, but clearly that wasn't enough.
Okay, good. Yeah, clearly we've got to continue to monitor, is what your paper shows.
Yeah,
good. Well, really interesting. We're going to move on to the second approach for engineering viral resistance, CRISPR-Cas9based virus resistance. But let's take a break before we do, Devang. And
sure.
So with that, we'll take a short break. We're talking to Devang Mehta, you've completed your doctor, Devang Mehta. We're going to come back and talk about engineering, continuing to engineer viral resistance in plants and some of the challenges that we face. So thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast.
Hi, everybody. This is Kevin Fulto, the Talking Biotech Podcast. Back on June 13th, 2015, I started an experiment of trying to use a new type of media in order to disseminate scientific communication. That's this, the Talking Biotech Podcast. And whereas most podcasts fail by their 12th episode, here we are at episode 130-something and still going strong. And I really owe it all to the people who listen and the kind words and thoughts that people give us. It hasn't always been smooth sailing. There's been lots of rocky times and times when I've wanted to just say, forget it, just hang it up. But it's been the support of people who listen, along with friends like Paul Vincelli and all of our other co-hosts, let alone the outstanding speakers and interviewees who are here every week to talk to us. You know, it really means a lot to have friends who are willing to talk to you about their beautiful science. So as I always say at the end, tell a friend, write a review on iTunes, and as we move into year four, I think it's actually getting stronger, and I think it's getting better. And maybe I don't sound as bad as I did in the beginning. Maybe. But thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Looking forward very much to the next episodes.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast with Dr. Devang Mehta. Dr. Mehta is a recent PhD graduate from the Group of Biotechnology at the Institute of Molecular Plant Biology in the Department of Biology at the Swiss Federal Institute for Technology, and is bound for a postdoc in the University of Alberta soon as well. And so welcome back, Devang. It's good to have you here.
Thanks.
All right. So the second approach or strategy for engineering resistance, we just did an RNAi discussion, is based on CRISPR-Cas9. And this is, I must say, the first time I read about it, I thought it was a very fascinating, creative approach. But there are limitations as well, as we'll discover. And Devang, let's start by explaining to people how this approach for engineering virus resistance works.
Okay. So CRISPR-Cas9 is actually originally, or in nature, CRISPR-Cas9 is a way in which bacteria defend themselves against viruses. So what happens is that in bacteria, you have viruses that come into the cell, and what the bacteria tries to do is it uses pieces of the virus's DNA to defend itself against the virus. So it takes in pieces of the virus, puts it into its own genome, the bacteria, and then transcribes it in a particular way, which is and then produces these short RNA molecules that are again bound to a protein called Cas9. And all this is happening in the same bacterial cell. And then the Cas9 gets guided onto the virus's DNA and then basically cuts the virus's DNA and then gives immunity to the bacterial cell. And then what we reasoned was that since the virus that we are working with is also a DNA virus, it could be interesting to try and use the system, you know, in a plant where it has never been, it hasn't evolved in plants. It's a completely new system for a plant. And so it's also completely new for a plant virus. So plant virus would possibly not have evolved resistance to this mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So what do you have to do to actually take advantage of the CRISPR-Cas9 approach to engineering resistance? What does that actually look like?
So to do that, in plants, you just need to introduce two genes. So you have one gene which codes for the Cas9 protein, and then you have a second gene which codes for something called the single guide RNA or the synthetic guide RNA. And the guide RNA is basically a very small piece of DNA of RNA that is complementary to a segment of the virus's DNA. So it can bind to a segment of the virus's DNA. And then you code for these two. So you have genes which code for these two components in your plant, and then the plant transcribes both of these genes, produces a Cas9 protein and a guide RNA. These two things form a complex together, which is called the Cas9 guide RNA complex. And then this gets guided onto the virus's genome and creates a cut on the virus.
Cuts that virus in somewhere and disables it, basically.
That's
the theory, right? That's the hope, right? So just to remind listeners, Devang mentioned two genes that are transferred into a plant to do this engineering. One is the Cas9 gene, as he mentioned, and that comes from bacteria. And the single guide RNA is designed to match the virus. So we've got one bacterial gene and one viral sequence that we've inserted into the plant with the outcome to cut the virus and hopefully disable it. Is that where we're at?
Yeah, I think that's a fair summation.
Okay, so what did you? I think we framed it pretty well. What did you find? When you actually implemented this approach?
Right. So we transformed cassava plants to express these genes, and then the first thing I did was to infect these plants with the virus in our greenhouse. So we also had plants without the RNA component. So these were kind of our controls, where they only express the Cas9 protein, but the Cas9 cannot go and find the virus's DNA because it lacks the virus RNA or the virus-derived RNA. And then we infected these plants, and we found that overall there wasn't any significant difference in terms of virus symptoms between the control plants and the transgenic plants. Which is to say that both sets of plants were infected to similar degrees with the virus,
which is not what you'd expect at all. But you
no, yeah. Well, that wasn't what we hoped to see.
Yeah, right. So sorry, I cut you off.
No, you can. Okay, so when we saw this result that we couldn't see a significant difference between the test plants and the control plants, we wanted to find out why.
Yes.
And so we had actually sampled the plants at an earlier time point, which was 3 weeks, and we sampled them again at the last time point of the experiment, which was 8 weeks after infection. And then what I decided to do was to try and sequence again all the viruses that were present in the control plants and the test plants, and to try and compare them to see, what was the effect of the Cas9 on the virus's genome. Did the Cas9 actually even cut the virus's genome?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe it just failed to cut the virus, viral DNA. Yeah.
Possibly,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, should I go on?
Yeah, yeah. I think you're walking us through quite well. So.
Okay. So when I looked at the sequencing results, what I could see that was that some of the viruses in the transgenic plants or in our control plant, in our test plants, which were expressing both the Cas9 and the guide RNA, these viruses did show mutations at the target site. So these viruses looked like they had been cut by the Cas9 protein and then repaired by the plant's endogenous DNA repair machinery. So they had kind of these missing base pairs, or they had additional base pairs, which let us know that these viruses had been cut by the Cas9.
Yeah, which is a big deal. I mean, I'm listening to you. I've looked at the paper, of course, but I'm listening to you describe, you know, the sort of the exploration that you went through in this project. And the question arose, did the Cas9 even cut the virus? Well, yes, it did. And you have evidence that it was, but it was.
Yeah, prepared. I mean, this was. Exactly. This was so there was both a kind of positive as well as negative to the fact that we could see these edited viruses.
Yeah.
Because the hope was that, okay, if we cut the virus's DNA, does the DNA get repaired? Does the DNA get degraded? We don't know.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And when we started detecting these repaired viruses, I think I already had a sense that that the results were not going to be too positive, because the fact that the plant could repair these viruses pretty well kind of shows that the system would not work as an immune system.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you, what gave you a clue? So the cutting occurred of the virus, yay, but repair occurred, boo. And so what was sort of the first clue that made you think, oh, maybe this isn't going to work because the virus is being repaired by the very own plant, that it, the plant's defense or the plant's own repair mechanism.
Right. So we already knew that the system wasn't working because our plants showed, you know, very clear symptoms that they were infected by a virus.
Yeah, that's right.
But maybe we thought that maybe this could be because either the protein wasn't expressed, but we checked this and the protein was expressed.
Okay. The Cas9 protein.
The Cas9 protein and the other gene.
Okay.
But this is also something that becomes difficult. So when you sequence these viruses, you're not going to sequence the viruses that were degraded because they're no longer present. So there's no way to say, you know, what proportion of the viruses were actually degraded.
Good point.
We are only going to be able to sequence either the viruses that were left untouched or the viruses that were cut and then repaired by the plants.
Yeah. So DNA repair has taken place. So how do you know, and what is the consequence of that?
Yeah. So the next thing we looked at was we had these DNA sequences and they looked like they were repaired, they've been cut and they've been repaired. So the next idea was to try and see, you know, what is the outcome of this repair? You know, does this DNA still code for a wild protein? What type of repair actually happened? So then what we did was we tried and we looked at we translated these DNA sequences into protein sequences.
Okay.
To try and see, because we had targeted actually a DNA portion of the virus, which was coding for two viral proteins. So these two wild genes kind of overlap on the virus's genome. So by cutting this segment of the virus, we are hoping to actually inhibit the production of two wild proteins at once.
Okay. In one cut.
In one cut, exactly.
Yeah.
And then when I looked at the protein sequences, I found that quite a few of these viruses seem to have the same protein level mutation. So they had the same amino acid from the wild type virus had been replaced with a new amino acid at the same position in a lot of different viruses. So this gave us a clue that, okay, there's something special going on here.
So replacing certain genetic letters or nucleotides with others, basically.
Well, not the nucleotides, but the amino acids coded.
Good point. Thank you. Yep.
So we found that we had these substitution mutations, which is basically what we call a mutation where one amino acid is substituted for by another amino acid, or basically where the DNA which codes for one amino acid is substituted for by DNA that codes for a second amino acid.
Okay.
And then we found that a lot of these viruses had this same mutation where histidine was substituted for by another amino acid, and this was occurring at not a very high frequency, but a high enough frequency for us to investigate further into this. And then when I looked into this specific mutation into a little more detail, I found that it was caused by a very simple mutation at the DNA level. So there was just an extra T base. So an extra thymine introduced into the target region of the virus.
I know the answer to this because I've read the paper, but what was the outcome of that? These changes basically associated with the original cutting by the Cas9 protein. What was the outcome?
So what happened was that we had this population of viruses where we just had a single letter of DNA that was added to their genome. And this happened quite close to the target site where the Cas9 was supposed to cut the virus's DNA. And then when we took this sequence and we tried to re-simulate the cutting of Cas9 and a guide RNA on this sequence, we found that the sequence was resistant to cleavage by Cas9. So this insertion of a single base stopped the Cas9 from cleaving this DNA.
Yeah, that's really huge. And so you used a phrase in that title, looking at the wrong paper, but it's editing resistant strains, I think is the phrase.
Yeah, editing resistant Gemini viruses. So
Gemini viruses, yeah.
So these Gemini viruses can no longer further be cut by our Cas9.
Yeah. So the very defense mechanism that you engineered was successful in cutting the virus, but sometimes the plant repaired those cuts, but it did so with some variation introduced, some mutation introduced. Consequently, those viral strains or strands now are resistant to the single guide RNA that matched originally, but no longer because of this introduced mutation.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was more interesting was that we had many different transgenic lines that we tested, expressing the same machinery, but kind of as replicates, and we found this same mutation happening in a lot of viruses infecting three different lines. So this wasn't a result that we found due to chance, but there seemed to be some indication that this virus was being kind of, this mutation was kind of selected for.
Yeah. So certainly that your result and another result of a paper that you and I both commented about over Twitter, but certainly focusing on your paper, it really raises a question as to whether this creative approach would generate durable resistance against DNA viruses. I mean, that's what I've walked away with. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that was kind of where we concentrated on our discussion session, which is, actually when you have these viruses that are being cut and they're being repaired, let's say 9 times out of 10, the repair is still going to result in a non-functional virus.
A
non-functional virus genome.
So most of them, they're going to be non-functional.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But the fact that in our study, we were able to detect the same mutation and the same virus in three different plants at a relatively high proportion seems to show that it is also possible that using the system could kind of induce the evolution of new stable viruses. And this could be a real problem when we think about biosafety and containment and the impact to which, or the extent to which we want transgenic plants that can shape the evolution of new viruses.
I know. Yes, beautifully stated. So, in the first example from your first paper that we discussed, the RNAi approach there was really no finding of a problem with the RNAi approach to virus resistance. It was simply a matter of we've got to make sure that we account for all the variability that might be in there out there in the viral population in agriculture in order for a durable resistance or semi-durable resistance to be achievable. So it's we're just learning how to better employ RNAi against viruses. So I think that was an important find, but it doesn't sort of throw it out the window. In contrast, engineering plants to use CRISPR-Cas9 molecular machinery to fight against viruses. We've got to be very careful because we're actually generating novel biotypes in the plants that have these nanomachines, basically. Is that a accurate summary as well?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, with RNAi, you know, we kind of did change the virus population, but we didn't really create a new virus type. Whereas with the CRISPR, there is this risk that you're creating a new, or you're kind of redirecting evolution in some way to create new virus species. And, you know, this is something we need to talk about as a community, because we need to try and figure out whether this is a risk that's worth taking.
Yeah, totally. Well, I think the durability question alone is you know, cause abandonment of that approach. But sure. We also do need to, I agree, we need to, you know, as scientists, public scientists, be open, have open discussions about, you know, whether, I mean, I think you and I know you enough, well enough through Twitter to think that I can describe you as similar to me. And that is, I'm in favor of the wise use of genetic engineering, the wise use of genetic engineering. And there are many applications that, you know, I think would fit that bill, but this might be one that's not so wise, and we have to really be careful that we've studied the risks that you've identified in your paper.
Yeah, I think our paper just calls for more study on this aspect of, mm-hmm. of this technology.
Okay, good. Certainly a good call for it. So is there anything else you would like our listeners to know?
So we are, you know, so I think we don't want to kind of say that, you know, using CRISPR for virus resistance is never going to be possible, because, okay. you know, we do need to study. Maybe, so in our study, we used a single guide RNA, so a single cut on the genome, and maybe using multiple guide RNAs, so causing more cuts in the genome could stop this process of evolution of new viruses enough. There's other possibilities. So we could try and engineer the CRISPR system to be adaptive to new viruses, like it is in bacteria. But there are lots of new things that we could still try with this technology, but it does need to be done a little more carefully.
Right. Okay. So I'll, yes, wave in a sort of a yellow flag on, and so not a red flag, but a yellow flag, just to raise the need, the concern and the need for more research. And I guess I'll add to that, Devang, that we are talking about CRISPR-Cas9 against DNA viruses, but listeners should be very clear, we're not talking about all CRISPR-Cas9 applications, because, for example, you may use CRISPR-Cas9 to transfer a resistance gene, an R gene, from plant A into plant B,
exactly.
and that is entirely as distinct as it could possibly be from the CRISPR-Cas9 defense mechanism against DNA viruses that you've studied and described. So I know you understand this, but I want to make sure
all
our listeners understand we're not talking about all CRISPR-Cas9 applications. There are many that this wouldn't even be under this umbrella of possibilities. So you want to add?
This is a very narrow application of CRISPR-Cas9, where, you know, you need the Cas9 protein to be expressed in the plants that you leave in the field.
Right.
But even our lab is also working on ways in which to try and use CRISPR-Cas9 to change resistance genes and to change other genes in cassava. And these are not applications that would result in this kind of an outcome. So they're completely safe in terms of in this aspect, at least.
Right, in terms of generating new biotypes of the pathogen, it doesn't even apply in the case of what you're describing, and what I'm talking about as well, these many other applications.
Sure.
Right. Yeah, so that's an important distinction. I'm glad we were able to...
So we talked about two methods to engineer resistance to these viruses, but our lab is also working on ways in which to use natural resistance sources. So there is a source of natural resistance to cassava mosaic viruses. And we are trying to and identify which gene is involved in this. And possibly we might even use CRISPR to try and engineer this resistance into the cassava genome later on.
So the natural source, is it, maybe it's something you're not in a position to talk about, but is it a genetic issue, I guess, or
Yeah, it's a single genetic locus, and a colleague of mine is working on this for his PhD to try and identify which specific genetic mutation confers resistance to these viruses, because a lot of the time viruses need to use plant proteins to replicate, and maybe you have a cassava plant which produces a certain variant of a protein which the virus cannot use. And then that means that the virus is no longer able to replicate it.
Right, right. Good, good point. Yeah. Well, maybe we'll have your colleague on the program when you know, when that work is you know, at that point where he or she is ready to talk about it. So
sure.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure to interview you, Devang, and yeah, thanks for taking the time to explain your work, and thanks for publishing it on a preprint server so we could all see it. Appreciate your efforts.
No, thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Talking Biotech, write a review on iTunes, and tell a friend to listen, as your support allows us to deliver more about exciting science to more people. I'm Paul Vincelli, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.